Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Christmas Cat Blues by Alison O'Leary. Narrated by Helen Langford. 1. Aubrey settled more comfortably on the roof of Molly's car as he watched the delivery man wrangle a large tree from the back of the open truck and drag it up to the front door, clutching it around the trunk and pulling it behind him. Next to him, Vincent continued the slow, languid washing of his right ear. Leaning back against the porch, the man closed his eyes for a moment and drew a deep breath before making his way back to the truck. Jumping down from the car, Aubrey padded over to the porch. He could smell the tree already, a fragrant, resiny smell that scented the cold winter air. He raised his head and looked up into the slate-grey sky. Snow was on the way. Inside Fireside House, a pair of cold eyes followed the visitor as he made his way around the large open-plan office, hand extended to the women who had instinctively risen from their chairs on his entrance, as if he was some sort of visiting royalty. He was good-looking, though, he had to admit it, tall and handsome in that old-fashioned movie star way, with a square chin and bright blue eyes that crinkled around the corners in a way that suggested he had a ready smile. His fair hair flopped very slightly over his forehead and gave an almost boyish charm to his appearance. The sharp cut of his grey suit, the crisp blue shirt, and the designer tie added to the effect too. But be that as it may, this bloke was going to make enemies if he kept poking his nose into the workings of the foundation, that was for sure. He continued watching as the man stopped to talk to Lucy, leaning over and looking interested in what she was working on. Lucy, sucking in her stomach, fluttered her eyelashes at him as she showed him some of the case files. He narrowed his eyes. This new chairman of trustees was nothing like the previous chairman, Charles. In fact, Charles, with his fat belly pushing against his shirt buttons and his propensity to start sweating after two glasses of wine, had been almost the complete opposite. It would never have occurred to Charles to show any more interest in the office staff than he would have done in a new printer. As far as Charles was concerned, the staff were just a part of the fabric of the building. He had certainly never bothered to speak to any of them. He doubted that Charles had even known their names. The only times that Charles was seen around Fireside House was when he had attended the quarterly meeting of the trustees, meetings at which he'd thrown his not inconsiderable weight around. He had been fond of Charles, though, in a lukewarm sort of way. He had certain qualities, the main one being his complete disinterest in the affairs of the Family Fireside Foundation, other than the opportunity it gave him to be king of the castle for the day. Outside, the snow began to fall, the soft white flakes swirling and brushing against the windows. In the distance, the sound of the waves crashing against the sea wall could just be heard. 2. Carlos lay on his stomach on the rug in front of the fire, flicking the pages of a football magazine. He looked up as Jeremy came in, followed by Vincent, who slipped in behind him and joined Aubrey under the Christmas tree, which was waiting to be decorated.
"Snowed off," said Jeremy. "Where's Molly?"
"Here," said Molly, coming through from the kitchen. "Did you have something to eat at the golf club?"
Jeremy shook his head.
"No, I had a quick drink with some of the lads and then came straight back, in case the weather got worse. I had a chat with one of the new members, Adam something or other. Interesting bloke. He struck me as being one of those eager types, but not in a painful way, if you know what I mean. Not like Ernest."
He laughed.
"Ernest by name, Ernest by nature. God, who calls their child Ernest these days? Although it's probably popular again now, like Albert and Enid."
"Is Ernest still teaching at Sir Frank's?" asked Molly.
"Last I heard. Amazing when you think about it. The smart money in the staff room was on him making a bolt for it before the end of his first term."
"You have to give him credit for sticking with it," said Molly, sitting down in the chair next to the fire, "even after the ankle-biting incident. What was it he used to say?"
Jeremy assumed a sombre expression and sank his chin slightly into his chest. "All children are a gift, and we must treat them accordingly." He didn't mention unwanted gifts, but he had a kind of air of innocence about him that you couldn't help liking. I can see him now, huddled outside in a cloud of tobacco smoke, even when it was raining, He never did what the other smokers on the staff used to do.
Why, what did they do?
Head off to the big cupboard in the art room. They chucked all the art stuff out and made it into a sort of little club room. They had chairs and a rug in there and everything.
Didn't the art teacher mind?
It was his idea. I suppose, he continued, it was a sort of alternative staff room.
Didn't the head object?
She pretended that she didn't know. Otherwise she might have had to do something about it. Anyway, amongst his other worthy contributions to the well-being of life at Sir Frank's, Ernest used to run the fundraising events and ask the kids for ideas. Honestly, you should have seen some of the suggestions.
Carlos looked up again from his magazine and grinned.
Yeah, I remember those. The best one was the annual granny fight.
The what? Asked Molly.
Annual granny fight. It was Frankie Gibbons' idea. He said that we should round up all the grannies in the neighbourhood and have a big bundle in the playground at the end of the summer term, and we could charge for tickets and take bets.
Yes, well, said Jeremy.
Frankie Gibbons had a vested interest. His granny weighed about 40 stone and could have given Mike Tyson a run for his money.
He shuddered slightly.
I still have nightmares about the time she turned up at parents' evening instead of Frankie's mother. It was practically a medical phenomenon.
What was? Molly looked perplexed.
The development of simultaneous spontaneous migraine, which necessitated some staff having to exit rapidly.
Molly laughed. What did Ernest say about the suggestion for a granny fight?
Well, of course, he took it very seriously and said that he'd look into it, but the school might have difficulty arranging insurance. Honestly, he just couldn't see that the kids were taking the piss out of him half the time. Mind you, when he was rushed to hospital with appendicitis, they did have a whip round and take him in 60 Benson and Hedges and a potted chrysanthemum.
Molly leaned forward and tickled Vincent under the chin, who stretched his paws in front of him and inched a little closer to her. Aubrey smiled. When Vincent had first joined the household, he had hung back as though afraid to get too close to them. Now he looked forward to their coming home as much as Aubrey did.
So tell me about this Adam, said Molly. Presumably he's local?
Jeremy nodded.
Moved here about 2 months ago, one of those big houses up on the headland, the ones with the huge bay windows. He's the southern area manager of one of the big banks. I can't remember which one now, although he did say. He's also just been appointed as the chair of trustees for the Family Fireside Foundation.
Has he?
Molly looked interested.
That's where we donated some of the funds from our last social event at the lodge. It was quite a lot in the end. The residents really threw themselves into it. It was great fun. Mind you, at the time it was just what everybody needed. It was just after...
Aubrey yawned and tucked his tail more tightly around himself. He remembered the social event well. It had been arranged not long after the murder at the Lilac Tree Lodge care home for the elderly, and both he and Vincent, as participants in the visiting pet scheme, had been allowed to go. They had spent most of the day observing the elderly residents and their visitors, playing hoopla and running egg and spoon races on the lawns, although the latter had ended in some disarray after two of the residents started brawling and hurling eggs at each other, after one of them accused the other of deliberately tripping him. As Molly said, it was a good job that the eggs were hard-boiled. He had even submitted to the indignity of the Guess the Weight of the Cat competition, although he had been less impressed when some bright spark had written 5 tons on the entry slip. He didn't know how much 5 tons was, but it seemed like a lot.
I've heard that the foundation do a lot of good work with the homeless, continued Molly, which is why we donated some of our funds to it. I hadn't realised until we moved here what a problem homelessness can be in coastal areas. I suppose that I'd always associated being homeless with inner cities.
Jeremy nodded.
Adam was telling me about it. Part of the problem is that employment tends to be seasonal, which obviously causes problems in the winter months. And also these areas seem to attract drifters. I can't say I blame them. I suppose if you've got nothing, you might as well have nothing in nice surroundings. And then there's the drug scene, although you get that everywhere.
I guess so, said Molly. So what does the foundation do in practical terms?
Quite a lot, one way and another. One of the things that they do is buy up old properties and convert them into flats, and they acquire land and build new blocks sometimes as well. One of their policies is to try to rehome people with a drugs problem away from the area, to give them a fresh start.
How do they decide who to give homes to? Do people just apply?
I think that they can, but it's mostly done through referrals, like social services or other charities.
Where do they get their money from? Asked Molly. It can't all be fundraising.
I think that the fundraising is mostly for public relations purposes. It helps them attract legacies. But they have a portfolio of investments that they finance most of the work with, as well as a substantial amount in a trust fund. And of course they do get rents from the properties.
Carlos put his magazine aside.
The original foundation was started by Sir George Renton. When he was a boy, his father died when he was 7 and left his mother with 6 children and no money. They lived rough for a while in the caves on the beach, and he said that it was an experience that he never forgot. After he got rich, he set up the Family Fireside Foundation to help families in difficulties, but now they help single people as well.
Molly looked at Carlos in astonishment. How on earth do you know all that?
There was a piece in the local paper.
Jeremy smiled slightly. Carlos taking an interest in current affairs, even if only at a local level, was a new development. He was definitely maturing.
How did Sir George make his money? Asked Molly.
Buttons and stuff, like making them, which,
Carlos added thoughtfully, was dead clever when you think about it. I mean, like everything has buttons, even nowadays. I bet there's like millions of buttons even in just this house.
Molly thought for a moment and then nodded. Carlos was right. There were probably at least a dozen buttons on the clothes that they were wearing now. She turned to Jeremy. How does the foundation work then? I mean, who actually runs it now?
It's run like any other business, really. It's just that their business is charitable. A group of trustees make the decisions on policy and planning and so on, and then there are paid staff who put it into practice. A bit like the government and the civil service, I suppose. The foundation's got a chief executive plus proper managers to handle things like finance and human resources, as well as a fundraising and public relations department. Like I said, just like any other business.
Right, Molly nodded. So are the trustees volunteers? I mean, they're not paid or anything.
Only expenses, said Jeremy.
Funnily enough, Adam was telling me that there's a vacancy on the board and they're looking for someone who lives locally. He asked me if I would consider him putting my name forward.
And will you?
Probably. I think it might be interesting. Something different, anyway.
3. Molly peered into the cardboard box and pulled out a fat wax candle in the shape of Father Christmas. She tipped her head to one side and regarded it fondly.
Goodness, we've had this for years. Since our first Christmas together, I think.
So a genuine antique, then, said Carlos. You ought to take it on the roadshow. Could be worth a fortune. I'll check for the next time it's coming to town.
Molly made a pretend swipe towards his head. Cheeky. Make yourself useful and unravel the fairy lights.
She delved into the box again and threw a great tangle of wires towards him. Despite their promises to themselves each year to make sure that the lights were properly stored, every year they got thrown in the box with the rest of the decorations, with the result that every year they had to be untangled. From their observation post beneath the Christmas tree, Aubrey and Vincent watched with interest as Carlos shook the tangle down before starting to pick it apart, his long, thin fingers delicately separating the strings. Aubrey always liked it when the Christmas decorations came out. It put everyone in a good mood, and it was only a matter of time before the big turkey got cooked, which always resulted in plenty of leftovers for him. If he could resist jumping up at the tree, that is. Last year, he had been marched from the house in disgrace after making a flying sideways leap at a spectacularly tantalising bauble and bringing the whole lot crashing down. It had taken quite a long time of pushing his face against the window and looking pathetic before they relented and let him back in again.
What time do you think Jeremy will be back?
Asked Carlos, an expression of fierce concentration on his face as he bent over the fairy lights.
Molly glanced at her watch. Any time now, I should think.
So, if he does this trustee thing, what does he have to do? Is it just like meetings and that?
I'm not sure, to be honest, Molly admitted. He'll tell us when he comes in.
Talk of the devil, she added as the front door banged.
Evening all,
said Jeremy, pushing open the door.
This all looks very festive.
He sank down on the sofa and reached towards the bottle of wine and glasses that stood on the coffee table.
So how did it go?
Asked Molly, shaking a rope of tinsel stars from the box.
Fine, interesting.
He poured himself a glass of wine and sat back.
We went to the Fox, where Adam told me about some of the other trustees. From the sound of it, there seemed to be quite a few of the big-bellied, self-important brigade, and most of them close to retirement. I think that, apart from Adam, I would probably be the youngest by about 10 or 15 years.
No women?
Jeremy shook his head. No. Adam said that the previous chairman, Charles something, was a bit of a misogynist, and the rest of the board followed suit. Charles was of the opinion that the only place for women at the foundation was doing the office work and making the tea. None of the senior managers are women. Adam said that once he's got his feet under the table, he's going to make a real effort to appoint some women to the board. The problem is having to wait until somebody retires or resigns, and then getting the others to agree. In the meantime, he's going to look at staffing and see if anything can be done there. Some training or promotion or something. Apparently the office staff haven't even got proper job titles. Adam said that everybody just calls them the girls, even though a number of them are middle-aged.
So how did Adam get appointed?
Usual story, the old boys' network. Adam's manager was about to retire. He's an old school friend of Charles. They've kept in touch over the years, and Charles happened to mention that he was also retiring and that they were looking for somebody to replace him at the foundation. Deal done. To be fair, I guess that was sort of how I was recruited too.
Didn't one of the existing trustees want to take over? Asked Molly.
Jeremy grinned. According to Adam, volunteers for the role were particularly conspicuous by their absence. He thinks that it's because they're frightened that they might have to do something other than turn up for meetings on expenses. Charles did little enough, and I suspect that the other trustees do even less. In theory, the trustees propose policy, but in reality, I think that they more or less rubber stamp anything that's put in front of them. I can see why Adam wants to change things. It sounds like it was running a bit like a Victorian gentleman's club.
Molly nodded. Did he explain what the role of trustee involves? What it should involve, I mean?
Jeremy nodded. Pretty much. He told me how the trust works, what I'd have to do and so on. It sounds really interesting.
Carlos crawled over to the light socket and plugged in the fairy lights. He sat back on his heels, head to one side, and smiled.
Excelente.
He turned back to look at Jeremy.
Do you have to do it in your own time, or will you get time off work? Well, obviously I'll have to get approval from the inspectorate, but they're generally pretty good when people are volunteering. And given that I work a lot from home now, it would probably just mean juggling things around a bit. There's 4 meetings a year, plus a special trustees meeting, so I can't see it making too much impact on the inspection work.
Molly nodded. Jeremy's work as one of Her Majesty's Inspector of Schools was very important to him, she knew. Sometimes she thought, too important. It would be good for him to have another interest.
Actually, he continued, Adam has invited me to sit in on one of their meetings and also asked me to their trustees' annual Christmas lunch, even though I don't take my place on the board until the new year.
Where's it held? Asked Molly.
At a local hotel. All the staff at the foundation and the trustees get together and have a 3-course meal paid for by the foundation. The highlight, apparently, is the chairman's speech, followed by the chairman's toast. They have a claret jug that they bring out every year, one of those glass things with a silver top. It belonged to Sir George Renton, and the chairman pours from it and raises the toast. They're really careful with it. It's only used by the chairman for the toast, and then it goes back into wraps. To be honest, it all sounds a bit boring.
4.
Max swept the snow from the windscreen of his car with the back of his gloved hand and glanced across to the road outside. If the traffic continued at this snail's pace, it would be past midnight before he got home. He felt a twitch of irritation. Anybody would think that the country had never seen snow before. He got in the car and switched on the radio. The sound of Hark the Herald Angels boomed back at him. He switched it off and hunched his shoulders, glancing up at the windows of Fireside House. A large, stripy creature with a white tip to his bib, paws and feet stared implacably back at him, its tail wrapped tightly around its body. He felt a spurt of anger. Eric! He hated that bloody animal. Every night when he left the building, he made a point of finding it and chucking it out. And every morning it was back inside. Howard had come to be living in Fireside House. Nobody seemed to know. It had just turned up one day. And of course, the office staff loved it. Once they started feeding it, that was it. They were stuck with the creature. He wouldn't mind if it did anything useful like catch a few mice, but all it seemed to do was sleep and wind him up.
He tipped his head back against the headrest and let his mind drift back over the day. He had been as startled as the next one when the new chairman had turned up unexpectedly. They should have been given some warning that he was coming. He shouldn't be allowed to just drop in when he felt like it. He felt a sudden thrill of panic, an unexpected sensation that he'd been experiencing on and off all afternoon. The last thing that any of them needed was for somebody to start being overly interested in the affairs of the Foundation. It had unsettled the office staff too, so much so that they had more or less wasted most of the afternoon, until one of them had suggested putting up the Christmas decorations and started dragging out the plastic cartons stored in the office cupboard. They had already begun the annual Grimfest known as the Secret Santa days ago, and it was seriously getting on his nerves. Whatever sadist invented it ought to be shot, or better still, lashed to a holly tree and pelted with plum puddings, preferably rock-hard ones. The maximum spend agreed by the staff was a fiver. A mingy fiver. It was a joke. Honestly, what could you buy for a fiver? Nothing that anybody would actually want, that was for sure. The result was that everybody ended up with stupid jokey presents that almost certainly went in the bin as soon as they got home. Last year he had received a pair of red socks which rang out jingle bells every time he moved. But he'd got his revenge this year. He had bought Sue, whose name he had picked out of the hat, some cheap bath foam. That'd get her eczema itching. He huddled further into himself while he thought about the office staff. They were all right, he supposed. He'd worked with worse. At least they didn't go around treading on each other's heads to get promotion. Mostly on the basis that there was no promotion available to get, no matter how hard they worked. There was only one job title available in the general office, and that was clerical and administration. By virtue of age and experience, one or two of the women were considered to be more senior and supervised younger members of staff, but there was no official recognition of that. But by and large, lack of career opportunities notwithstanding, they did a good job of coping with the day-to-day affairs of the Foundation. There were very few problems that they couldn't deal with, even those that came in the form of potential clients turning up unannounced at Fireside House. Those that did were usually in a state of agitation and sometimes inebriation, but one of the women would make him or her a cup of tea and start ringing around the relevant agencies to get some immediate relief. If he was honest, he had to admit to himself that several of the women would have made good senior managers. Not that they would ever have the chance under the regime that the chief executive maintained. The chief executive's idea of rewarding the office staff topped out at giving them an afternoon off to do their Christmas shopping. This was on the basis that, at Christmas, the women did all the food and present shopping as well as all the cooking on the day, while the men toasted their asses in front of the fire and smoked cigars. But even that little bonus wasn't guaranteed. The women had to wait until he announced it, which he did by striding into the general office and announcing magnanimously that the office would be closing at lunchtime. And then, of course, they all had to thank him. Making himself a cup of tea in the small kitchen that afternoon and reluctant to go back to his office, Max had deliberately taken his time while he watched them decorate the office and talk about Adam and what to wear to the annual Christmas lunch. Like it was Royal Ascot or something, he thought. It was only a meal at a hotel. It wasn't even a very good meal. Last year there had been insufficient potatoes and the Christmas pudding and brandy sauce had been unpleasantly tepid. The best bit had been when Charles had argued with one of the waiters over a bottle of wine, which Charles had claimed was corked, as if he could tell. He was just showing off in front of the office workers, most of whom had done their best to look suitably impressed, while probably thinking what a twat he was. And the speeches were appalling, with everyone wearing their happy smiles plastered all over their faces and pretending to be interested. And as for the chairman's toast, although this year it was a new chairman, which would at least make a change from Charles trying to read his notes and dropping his glasses. His expression soured still further as he thought about the trustees, 10 of them in total, and what did they actually do? Turned up a few times a year to pontificate at meetings on subjects about which they knew nothing and cared even less, and staying at 5-star hotels for the privilege. He half suspected some of them of deliberately taking longer travel routes so that they could bump up their mileage claims. Then, after lording it about for a few hours, they went back to their tedious little lives and looked forward to the next time they could turn up at Fireside House and think themselves important. He sighed and leaned forward, reaching for the key to start the engine. He might as well make a move. He'd be sitting here all night otherwise. The downstairs was in darkness as he drew up, just a faint light showing in the front bedroom window. She'd obviously taken herself off to bed. Good. That meant with a bit of luck, he wouldn't have to see her before the morning. It wouldn't have killed her to put the outside lights on, though. He parked the car and let himself in, trying not to make a sound. Too late. The landing light snapped on. He looked up the stairwell to the cross face of his stepmother staring down at him, the grubby pink quilted dressing gown falling open to reveal a stained nightdress. About bloody time. I've been waiting hours for you. I had to get my own supper. He suppressed a sigh. It had seemed such a good idea at the time. After his father had died and left the house to both of them, their first thought had been to sell it and split the proceeds. But the more they had thought about it, the more it seemed to make sense to keep it. It was a big, detached, four-bedroomed house with plenty of space for both of them. They had always got on pretty well, and Stella had still been working then. He'd sold his own little house on the new estate and moved in. With a little effort in their own sitting rooms and bathrooms, they had hardly seen each other. But since she had retired, she had sunk further and further into herself, and now he seemed to have found himself in the role of reluctant carer. He looked up again into the sour, wrinkled face. For God's sake, the woman could at least brush her hair instead of letting it hang down in lank strands. And when was the last time she had seen a dentist? Stella had been a smart woman when his father had first met her, an office manager with a trim figure and a wide smile. He wouldn't recognise her now. In just 10 short years, she had gone from being an attractive woman in late middle age to a shrivelled old shrew with bad breath. He turned his back on her and went through to the kitchen. Shutting the door firmly behind him, he poured himself a beer and leaned back against the work surface. If only the old cow would take a tumble down the stairs. 5. Carlos pulled the carrot out of his parka pocket and poked it into the large lump of snow and then carefully placed two pieces of coal above it. Pulling his scarf, in the colours of the Brazilian national football team, from his neck, he tied it with a flourish around the place where the two boulders of snow met. From the warmth and safety of the kitchen windowsill, paws tucked neatly beneath them, Aubrey and Vincent watched as he stood back and admired his handiwork. Aubrey turned to Vincent.
What is it?
A snowman.
A what?
A snowman. A man made out of snow. Aubrey tipped his head to one side and looked again at the big, white, lopsided figure.
What's it for?
Vincent shrugged.
Dunno, mate.
They both turned at the sound of a car driving slowly along the road, the driver sticking in second gear and inching along to avoid skidding. They watched as Jeremy got out and pulled his coat more tightly around him. Spotting them on the windowsill, he grinned and waved, and then, sighting Carlos, he bent down and gathered a handful of snow. Patting it carefully into a ball, he took aim and struck Carlos squarely on the back. Carlos spun round and immediately gathered up a great ball of snow of his own and lobbed it in Jeremy's direction, running for cover to the far corner of the garden as he did so. Aubrey and Vincent watched in amazement, their heads flicking from side to side as the snowballs came thick and fast, until at last Jeremy put his hands up in breathless surrender.
What on earth?
Molly leaned forward and peered out of the window.
They'll be soaked.
She turned as the back door opened and Jeremy came in, stamping the snow from his shoes and rubbing his hands together, his eyes bright and his hair damp. Behind him crept Carlos, hand raised with one final snowball.
Carlos!
Warned Molly. He pulled a face and threw the snowball back outside. Molly smiled, a warm, indulgent smile that belied the harshness of her warning.
I'll stick the kettle on, she said.
So, turning to Jeremy, how did it go? Was it interesting? Funnily enough, he said, it was. You know, I must have passed Fireside House dozens of times, but I've never really noticed it before, and yet it's in the middle of the high street. Is it that big place near to the department store? The one with the gates? Asked Carlos.
I go past there on my way to college.
Jeremy nodded.
That's the one. It's weird. You go in and it's like a different world.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?